All right, so we are at John 18, starting at verse 10, and we're only going to make six verses in today's class, six verses, that's all, actually seven, 10 through 16 would be seven verses, and there is a particular reason. The focus here this morning is on protective anonymity. This is something we talked about maybe a little over a year ago as we started off the class. Who can give me a quick definition of this idea that we talked about over a year ago, protective anonymity? What is it and why is it important? They're protecting people from being in trouble. And the implications of that is what? Why is that important for us to highlight and to recognize if we find it in the New Testament Gospels? Yeah, very good. Very good summary. Thank you, Sue. Basically, really, really proud of your humility as well. protective anonymity is something that we're going to be looking at in two of these passages here in this short, small section. We find the first right off is John 18:10. Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. John's gospel is the only gospel to mention these two names, Peter's name and Malchus's name. So this is something many scholars point out. This is a good example of what's come to be known as protective anonymity. And you can't really find a better example of it than here, especially as this story is recounted in the Synoptic Gospels. Here, when we see this arrest scene in the olive orchard, remember we talked about that last time, Gethsemane is the olive press, and that word for garden is better translated as estate or field or orchard. This is basically this estate where they have the olive press, and they're on the Mount of Olives. So this is the place of the olive orchard where they're meeting. And then Judas, along with officers and soldiers of the high priests, arrive at Jesus' location with swords and clubs in hand. Though John identifies Peter as the man who took up the sword and assaulted the servant, in the Synoptic Gospels, the assailant's identity is cloaked in anonymity. So in Matthew 26, we read, "And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword." Mark, "one of those who stood by." And then Luke, "one of them struck the servant of the high priest." Now, here is a few of the commentators from the 1500s to the present and their evaluation of this interesting anonymity. So Calvin writes, "Peter's name is not mentioned here," he's commenting on Matthew 26, "by the evangelists, but John assures us that it was Peter who is here described, though the name is suppressed." He doesn't tell us why the name is suppressed. He just acknowledges the name is suppressed in the Synoptic Gospels. John Wesley writes, 1755, "No other evangelist names Peter, nor could they safely. But John, writing after his death, might do it without any such inconvenience." A commentator by the name of Albert Barnes.
After Peter's death.
After 1832, a commentator named Albert Barnes writes, "The synoptists concealed the name, probably because they wrote while Peter was living, and it might have endangered Peter to have known it." For others to have known his name as the assailant. J.C. Ryle, "John's gospel was written long after the other three, when Peter and Malchus were both dead, and their names could therefore be safely mentioned." Philip Schaff, before the turn of the century, before the turn of the previous century, 1882, "The earlier evangelists omit his name, perhaps from motives of prudence." And Westcott, famous Greek New Testament scholar, the Westcott Fort Greek manuscript. "The incident is described by all the evangelists, but John alone mentions the names of Peter and Malchus. It is easy to see why these were not likely to be particularized in the original oral gospel while both were alive and at Jerusalem." And then Queen Victoria's chaplain, F.W. Farrar, the synoptics suppress Peter's name from obviously prudential reasons which no longer existed when St. John wrote. Now, my favorite are the last two. These are really colorful. C.H. Dodd is a liberal scholar who basically was looking, he evaluates the fourth gospel, and he says, look, it's a collection of source material, not written by a guy named John. It's source material. But if you actually look at the quality of the source material, it's really reliable, his true historical stuff. And then others following Dodd said, look, if it's really that reliable and historical, do we need to suppose that it's source material? Isn't the better explanation that it's actually an eyewitness? So anyway, Dodd said, it is not legitimate to assume from the outset that the identification of the assailant as Simon Peter and of the slave as Malchus is fictitious. In other words, it's not historical fiction. It's not legitimate to say this was invented later, since, you know, which is what some people argue, that when you have later names, it's basically someone's attempt to be, you know, to show that it's historical. He says it's not legitimate. If we are to take account of the general probabilities of the situation, we should reflect that if there were two swords among the 12, as Luke says there were, it is more than likely that Peter had one of them. And if he had, he was, so far as we know him, not the kind of man to let it rest in its sheath. Isn't that a great observation? It is not difficult to see why it might have been covered over at a time when Peter was a marked man. In other words, in Acts 12 and other places, he's in and out of prison. It's like, we don't want to add something else to his rap sheet. And it was not politic to let him be represented as a man of violence, above all, as one who deliberately affronted the high priest in the form of his servant. And the last one I want to quote from you is from a guy named Gerd Thiessen from 1991. And here's the guy who actually uses the term that then becomes known as protective anonymity. He says, it seems to me that the motive for this anonymity is not hard to guess. Both of them had run foul of the police. The one who draws his sword commits no minor offense when he cuts off someone's ear. As long as the high priest's slave was alive, it would have been opportune to mention names. Their anonymity is for their protection. That's the key phrase. Only in Jerusalem was there reason to draw a cloak of anonymity over the followers of Jesus who had endangered themselves by their actions. I think that's probably the best way to look at it. A lot of these commentators were saying that it's not until Peter's death. John's gospel is written much later. Well, until Peter's death. Peter dies in 64. Doesn't necessarily have to be after Peter's death. It just probably is from the range when Peter leaves Jerusalem to the time of his death. That's the range. The synoptic gospels are written, and they're obviously protecting Peter, though they are familiar with who is the culprit. At least with Matthew and Mark. Matthew is a disciple. Mark is Peter's traveling associate and translator and the writer of the Gospel of Mark. So he takes Peter's gospel and puts it into writing, according to early church history. Peter, if Mark is Peter's gospel, Mark would be familiar with who the assailant is. There's some protection going on. Now, Luke, it's possible that Luke is merely recounting that same verbiage, that he's a later gospel. But if you look at the implications here in this chart below, that one of the things that this does is it says the synoptics were probably written, you could put a terminus date here, at the latest, they're pre-64, the pre-Peter's date, death. Now, Luke, perhaps not. Perhaps it's just using the same language because he didn't know. Luke was not a disciple of one of the 12 disciples. In fact, he's a traveling associate of Paul. So perhaps he didn't know. All right. But we do have other information that shows Luke is earlier than 64 because Paul actually cites a section in his letter to Timothy of Deuteronomy and of Luke's gospel, and he calls both scripture. Luke appears to have been written. He quotes a section of Jesus that's only found in Luke's gospel, and he calls it scripture, which means it's written and also as authoritative as Deuteronomy. So basically, the implications then, you can see in that chart, the typical date for Matthew is 75 to 85. If you're looking at New Testament scholars and you say, when do you think the average date that you get these days is 75 to 85? Mark, a little bit earlier, 65 to 75. Luke, 80 to 90. And then John, 90 to 100. Well, those dates just, when you look at this issue here, it's at least something that gives you pause to think. What are the implications that here someone is trying to protect Peter? Well, you don't try to protect a guy who is no longer with us. All right, so protective anonymity is a good way to think about this. Now, also in John, we've discovered that John 5 had some indications that because of the present tense language, there is in Jerusalem this pool, John 5, 2 and 3, with five porticos. It's like me saying, there is in New York Twin Towers. That sounds weird, isn't it? There are in New York Twin Towers. That's the wrong, there used to be would be the way to say it, right? Well, if John is writing this after the destruction of Jerusalem in 90-something A.D., why did he say there is in Jerusalem, and with two other present tense verbs, where people were laid, didn't say were laid, it says where people are laid and presented. So he has this these strange verbs that describe that that present tense, that Jerusalem and all of its the areas there by that pool, which were destroyed. I mean, Josephus described it as a plain, it looked like a plowed field, with the exception of this one wall that showed what had been there before, which is what we know as the Wailing Wall. All right, so if that's the case, there also isn't any hint of this Jewish war in John's Gospel. So the start of the Jewish war, 66 A.D., you can kind of say, look, all the four Gospels are pre-65, 66. This is a general... an argument based on the eyewitness testimony and some of the internal evidences that we discover here as we evaluate things like protective anonymity. That last bullet point, so the fact that John identifies Peter may be an indication that Peter had already died, but it's not necessary. It could just be that he had left Jerusalem at a time when he was no longer under threat of the Jewish authorities. So we had also seen, as we've looked at John's Gospel thus far, that there are all these indications, not only that John, Paul cites and interacts with language that's exclusive to the Jesus we find in John. A lot of those exclusively what scholars call the Johannine voice, the Johannine Jesus. Paul is regularly citing not only or alluding to not only those ideas that are exclusively in John, but he also regularly alludes to the narration information, those sort of the words from the beginning of the Gospel of John and the themes. So we saw that in chapter 1 and chapter 3 and chapter 8, all these places where John, the narrator, where, for example, he talks about in John 1:12, this idea that whoever believes can become his children. That idea of adoption is exclusive. We don't find that really in the Synoptics. We do find it all over in Paul. But we find very, very similar language in the Pauline epistles to what John had stated in his narration regarding Jesus. Well, that would be an argument that it's not merely the oral teaching of Jesus, but that Paul was familiar with the Gospel of John, in which case you start looking at the date of Paul's epistles and you work backwards. His epistles are written from the 40s to the 60s, and so John's Gospel, wherever you find those quotes and allusions, had to have been earlier. It's an argument for an earlier John, and this is an argument that a liberal scholar named John A.T. Robinson made in the 80s, early 80s. He was a very liberal scholar who came to conservative conclusions as he's rejecting C.H. Dodd and his views and saying, look, well, there's a better explanation. This is earlier. He wrote a book called The Priority of John. All right, now, next bullet point after the chart there, the servant's name was Malchus. Very, very interesting addition here. John reveals not only the name of the assailant, Peter, but also he identifies the name of the servant who was struck. Later, as we'll see in verse 26 of the same chapter, John will go on to disclose the family relationship between this man, Malchus, and another servant in the courtyard. He'll say that he was a relative of the man who was struck. So a number of skeptical scholars generally, as they see this as source material and then John as historical fiction or as fan fiction, they see that as this extra information that's crafted to make this look like it's true. Like, you can trust John. He's got extra information. That's the way a lot of the skeptical scholars read that. And they call that verisimilitude. Fancy word. But if the fourth gospel really is historical fiction, here's a big, big, important question. Why would the author take the time to invent character names like Malchus to add verisimilitude, but not identify the name of the author himself? Think about it. All the quote-unquote Gnostic Gospels, all these later Gospels that give secret information, the Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Thomas, they all are naming their Gospels with a particular disciple who's well-known. Gospel of Thomas, you know, these Gospels where you have not a whole lot of historical information embedded that you can evaluate and check. It's just this secret esoteric teaching that here's the missing piece to the puzzle. And when you read these Gnostic texts, it's very esoteric. Jesus he's from the play Roma, and it's Greek esoteric thinking that's very Gnostic and non-Jewish. But they're naming Thomas, who is known, because why? Because Thomas has credibility, because people are familiar with the names that are in the New Testament. Well, the Gospel of John, though, is an anonymous gospel. It's written by the disciple who was loved by Jesus, the beloved disciple. And nowhere is that author identify who that person is. There are different theories. This is John the Apostle. This is another Jerusalem disciple. But it's not identified. He leaves himself anonymous if you look at the ending of the gospel. Why would he do that if he's wanting to give this gospel verisimilitude? If it's a historical fiction, then you would say, here is the authoritative presentation. I, the best-loved apostle, John. You know, it just doesn't make any sense that you would leave it anonymous. It doesn't give it credibility. In fact, in the early, apart from the community from which this particular gospel was well-known, it sort of is this, it's a big question mark as to why does this gospel have the authority that it has? It doesn't lend more authoritative weight to it, leaving it anonymous. Question? Yes, there is and that's something we'll get into as we... We're going to get into that because essentially there's the more information that we read here. There's specific information that would be hard to explain with it being John the Apostle, particularly that relationship to the high priest and how he knows all of his servants. For a Galilean fisherman, that would be weird, unless he's connected in some other way. And we'll discuss that. Good observation. John 18, verse 11. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" So in many ways, this is parallel to the scene that we find in Matthew 16, which Jesus tells the disciples, he warns them that he's going to have to go to Jerusalem and be crucified and rise on the third day. Yet Peter takes him aside and says, "This shall never happen to you." And then what does Jesus do? He turns to him and says, "Get behind me, Satan." So Peter is espousing satanic theology. Why? Because he's focused on this world only. And Jesus is focused on his ultimate mission to come was to die. And that's what he talks about in John's gospel. You know, the time to be glorified has come. He's glorified in his death. Well, here, you know, basically Jesus stops them saying that's satanic theology. That is theology that really is satanic. It's I'm going to call you by the name of the person who has that theology, which is called a metonym in literature. It's like a metaphor with a name. A metonym. He gives him the name Satan because that's the theology he's espousing. Now, here in John's gospel, This is, it says there in Matthew, you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but the things of men. Here, Peter does the same thing, except for not with words, but with actions. He's resisting arrest. He's protecting Jesus. He still wants Jesus to have his best life now. And Jesus is saying, put your sword back into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup? Drinking the cup is another idea that's, it's mentioned in Matthew and then the Synoptics as well as John. And it's something that he's talked about here in the garden. You know, let this cup pass from me, Father, but not mine, but your will be done. And that cup is the idea of drinking the cup of suffering. But that's his mission. His mission is to come and to die for his people. And the question we need to ask is, are we sometimes espousing a satanic theology when we have in our minds the things of men rather than the things of God? Where we're only focused on this world and happiness and improvement and prosperity and earthly things rather than what Christ actually achieved in terms of securing our entrance into another world. Now, verse 12. So the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First, they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. We find something similar here in Luke chapter 3, and I've cited it for you here. In Luke 3, the first two verses, we find not once upon a time, there was a nice, like, you know, think about the way Jesus starts the parables or the way Aesop starts his fables. You know, there was a tortoise and a hare, and the important thing is the eternal principle. Don't be like the hare, be like the tortoise. That's not the way this is structured. This is structured as, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, a well-known historical figure, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, another well-known historical figure. We actually have an inscription with his name on it, being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee. We actually have some of his coins, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region of Iturea and Trichonis. We actually have some of his coins, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, another character mentioned in the writings of Josephus, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. It's super interesting that Luke here is mentioning all these political leaders and then mentions the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. First of all, the weird thing is it's two high priests, which is really unusual. And then we have to ask, well, why are there two high priests? That's kind of weird. John sort of does the same thing, showing that Jesus is taken to Annas and then to Caiaphas. It's like there are two high priests. He doesn't explain it, but he does say something unique, and that is John is the only one who tells us, even if you look at Josephus and other places, he's the only one that tells us the relationship that Caiaphas had to Annas. That is, he's his father-in-law. That's exclusive information that we get from John's gospel that actually winds up explaining, you know, this sort of godfather behind the scenes. He had been high priest back in 16 AD, and now he's kind of the puppet behind the strings there. And there was something called a Sagan. So when a high priest couldn't perform his duties, he had this deputy. He was also doing all the cleansing rituals so that if I was impure in my rituals at the temple, if I was suddenly defiled, somebody spits on you as you're walking down the stuff like that happened. So then they tag the other guy, the assistant, to do the rituals. Well, perhaps Caiaphas and Annas had that kind of relationship where it was the 50-50 thing. He was always having him do the rituals for him. In this case, that explains what we read both in Luke and in John's gospel, and those explain the relationship that we see in the other extra biblical information from Josephus and elsewhere. The picture I have here next to this information is the ossuary we discovered in 1991 with the name Caiaphas, Joseph Caiaphas the high priest. We actually found those and with the inscription, and it's something that is recognized by strong biblical scholars as well as general archaeologists. It's not disputed at all. So this is another example of whatever John is writing here, describing, is exactly what we find in the historical record. Top of page 3. Note how John reminds his readers of Caiaphas's unwitting prophecy. And that is, Caiaphas had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. This is basically really, really is important to John. He had mentioned it in John 11 when it happened. But now he reminds us, because essentially the structure of John's gospel is this. These are real eyewitnesses. They are really testifying to something that happened. In fact, they're testifying and they're witnessing. This is the language you find throughout. I testify. There is this bearing witness language. So a number of scholars, Andrew Lincoln is probably the best one, who really focuses on this idea of it's a court proceeding. And though the Jews are putting Jesus on trial, the Gospel of John is turning the tables and showing that they're the ones who are on trial for rejecting their Messiah. And this is a good example of that. Here, this is an unwitting prophecy showing what the ultimate purpose was. He had come to die for his people, and yet he was rejected by those same people, which is the language you find at the beginning of John's gospel. Though he came to his own did not receive him. So that's language in the beginning that's hinting at what the thesis is, and this is reminding you of that same thesis. Now we get into the fun stuff. Verse 15. So Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. First thing is, look at how much space he takes to describe this other disciple without naming him. You know, look at the parts that are highlighted. This disciple known to the high priest, a couple sentences later. So this other disciple who was known to the high priest. If he just named him, it would have saved you so many words. And this is in a short gospel, on a short scroll that's economizing words. There's a reason all the gospels are the same, similar length. Because they're economizing words, because scrolls are certain lengths. And they're expensive. And it's not easy to get ink and paper. It's expensive. And so you have these summaries. That's why they're called synoptics, by the way. The synopses of the stories of Jesus. And John's is a little bit different. But here we have this obvious place where this other disciple could have been named but isn't. So this is a great example of protective anonymity. By the way, if you want to do some reading on this idea of protective anonymity, the best book to get to on an intermediate level is Richard Bauckham's The Testimony of the Beloved Disciple. If you want to dig a little deeper than that book, more exhaustive is his book, the second edition of Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And if you want to start, if you don't want to wade through all those sort of New Testament, weird words that only New Testament, kind of like the way doctors will describe things not using the bed manner to their patients, and they use all these doctor terminologies. New Testament scholars do the same thing because it's their craft, right? So Bauckham has a book called Jesus, A Very Short Introduction. Cambridge scholar, but he writes here to using a lot of these same ideas, but at a more basic introductory level. And I like this book a lot. Although he has what I think is the older dating model, because he is kind of a moderate / liberal in some ways. But he has this emphasis on Jesus being attested to by actual eyewitnesses who are there in the eyewitness period. And that's the crucial thing for seeing the Gospels as sort of pre-70, because that's the crucial eyewitness period. And if these are eyewitnesses, then it's true, that it's at least has the ability to be true. It's more historical fiction if it's written in, second century sources, like a lot of the liberal critics said many, many years ago. But if it's within the eyewitness period, it is at least plausible that they're by eyewitnesses. And then you look at the internal evidence and you say, actually, the character of these gospels is not merely that they're written by eyewitnesses, but they are eyewitnesses who have firsthand information that really make sense of the geography and of the times and of the places. So Richard Bauckham has a great one time, and when I had the chance to interview him, he said that the interesting thing about an eyewitness is they tell you things you can't know apart from their own observation. You know, if Professor Plum is in the billiard room with a lead pipe and he kills Mrs. White, and there's nobody else to see it except for Colonel Mustard. If you're interviewing Colonel Mustard, you can't go back in time. You have to either trust him that he saw Professor Plum with the lead pipe in the billiard room, or you don't trust him. And so what you do in that kind of situation is you evaluate the credibility of the witness. Is he a credible witness or is he not? And you evaluate all these little things that he says, and you evaluate the credibility. And then if he is credible, you trust him. That's the way it works, not just merely in courts of law, but also in your relationship with friends. Is Jack the guy to help out in this particular situation or not? Is he a credible friend or not? How do you know that he's credible? Well, there's all those little details in your past relationship with him. Is he a reliable person or not? And that, I think, is a good way to evaluate John, as we've seen, as we've studied his gospel. All those little details that we've been looking at, where he mentions the things that are consistent with the time and the place. And another anecdote that's fantastic to focus on here is just when you evaluate the names in the Gospels. So Richard Bauckham does this in his Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. Two chapters, chapters 3 and 4, just do this really interesting work with names in the Gospels. If you take all the names from Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Acts, you put them and you say, okay, all the Peters equals one Peter, but there's a different Peter here, so there's a different guy. And you stack them up in terms of what are the most common names in the New Testament and Acts. What turns out when you compare them with the database of Palestinian Jewish names, it's almost identical in terms of the ratio of actual names that we have from ossuaries and other texts and trash bins and texts like the Gospels and Acts. The ratio is similar. Think about how if you're writing historical fiction, and you go back to write something from the 1830s or the 1920s, and you're trying to, you may think of older names, Margaret and Irma, but the question is, when you write that historical fiction, would you get the ratios right? You're like, what were the first, if you don't have Google, would you get the ratio right when you're putting these older names in your story? My guess is you wouldn't. And the interesting thing is, we only get this comparison by evaluating all the Gospels. So one person could make this up. If this is what you get from all the Gospels and Acts. In other words, these appear to be not historical fiction names. They appear to be actual names. And really what's interesting there is when you compare the Gospels to the Gnostic Gospels, the Gnostic Gospels have Mary Magdalene and Thomas and Judas. But when they have names that are not in the New Testament, there are always these Basilides and other names that are more like the Egyptian rather than Palestinian names that don't match the database, which gives us evidence these are later in time and later in geography and not first century Palestinian. These are first century Palestinian texts. And when these witnesses are proved in the small things, again and again and again, as we've seen, then you trust them with the big. All right, now, let's look at some of the details here. Now, one of the writers by the name of Stephen Smalley, is asking the question, is this other disciple the beloved disciple? Stephen Smalley says, it would be strange for John to be as familiar with the high priest's family as this passage only suggests. And there seems to be no good reason why, if the beloved disciple were involved in this incident, that he would not be designated as such. So in other words, this other disciple, is he the beloved disciple, the one we encountered in John 13? That's the first mention of the beloved disciple. And then he's mentioned here and there, certainly mentioned in John 21, where he's identified as the author of the gospel. So this guy in John 13 who reclines at Jesus' side, who is called the beloved disciple, who is the author of the gospel, is that him here in John 18? Is this other disciple that guy? He says, well, why wouldn't he identify him as the beloved disciple if it was? His presence would have suitably enhanced his role as a witness to Jesus. So, the above objection is best answered by seeing, I think, John 18:15 as another example of protective anonymity. If this particular disciple is protecting himself, he's even actually has a different shade here, just so that this beloved disciple, there's another degree of separation so that the family of priests don't connect him necessarily with the beloved disciple. Because why? Well, we'll find that out in the next chapter. I think the best explanation is that the beloved disciple in John 19:26-27 is given custody of Jesus' mother, Mary. He has to harbor her, give her safe harbor. And if he's protecting Mary, it's dangerous for him to be identified as the one who is the beloved disciple, particularly because if it comes out in a public document where others that's circulating in Jerusalem, he could be disowned and his property can be taken away. This, by the way, is one of the reasons why they're sharing their property and their goods in Acts 2, because this is what's happening. You're disinherited and you're sent out and you're excommunicated, which John's gospel makes clear. There were many people who were sent out of the synagogue. This other disciple is never mentioned by the synoptic writers. And though he's mentioned here, he remains nameless. So Joseph of Arimathea, out of fear of the Jews, was a secret disciple. And so a number of commentators have concluded that this other disciple is perhaps another Jerusalem disciple in a similar position. Other scholars, however, conclude that this unnamed disciple is none other than the beloved disciple for the following reasons. And I agree with these observations that do connect this other disciple to the beloved disciple for these reasons. Number one, both are anonymous. Number two, or B, both were present with Peter at the Garden of Gethsemane. C, the other disciple is being compared with Peter here in John 18 in the same way that the beloved disciple is compared with Peter throughout the fourth gospel. We talked about this a few lessons ago, and if you're interested, I can make that available to you if you don't remember. But basically, if you look at the entire structure of John's gospel, every time Peter is mentioned, except for one in John 6, he's always being compared to the beloved disciple or this other anonymous disciple. And this other disciple, anonymous disciple, always comes out a little bit better. And then, D, due to the structural similarities between John 18 and 20, as noted by a scholar like Herman Ritterboss or B.F. Westcott, the detailed description of the two disciples' entry into the courtyard is remarkable and anticipates their journey into Jesus' tomb. The entry into the courtyard, John 18, mirrors the structure of when they go to the tomb in John 20. And so before we look at E, look at the chart there. John 18, Peter follows Jesus with another disciple. John 20, Peter and the other disciple head to the tomb. 18:15. This other disciple was known to the high priest, 20:2. The other disciple is identified as the one whom Jesus loved. 18:15 again. The other disciple arrives well ahead of Peter, 20:4. The other disciple reached the tomb before Peter, 18:16. When Peter arrives at the gate, he waits until the other disciple shows up. The other disciple is already there, but he's inside the trial proceedings with Jesus. He comes out, says he goes out and goes to the gate, speaks to the attendant. He waits there until the beloved disciple grants him entrance. 20:5-8. When Peter finally arrives at the tomb, he and the beloved disciple enter into the tomb. Very similar structural parallels. And what's interesting here is if you look at verse 2 of chapter 20, the other disciple is identified as the beloved disciple. So that leads a number of scholars to say, here is where we find the identity of this other disciple. He's the beloved disciple, the writer of this gospel. Point E, the beloved disciple's presence at the cross is best explained as part of his continual presence with Jesus throughout the trial. In other words, he doesn't just show up out of nowhere there at the cross. You know, Jesus even said this. We looked at it last week. Jesus said, all of you will be scattered, each to his own home, but I am not alone, Jesus says, because the beloved disciple will be there with me. He doesn't say that. He says, but I'm not alone. The Father is with me. Interesting that he kind of presents this as everybody's going to leave. But then the beloved disciple is there at the cross. Does he just appear out of nowhere? Or is he the same guy that leaves, heads with Peter to the trial, follows Jesus to the cross? That makes the best sense. But then why? So I think what Jesus said when he was talking about you all will abandon me, I think he's talking to the 12. And the beloved disciple is this Jerusalem disciple who is kind of there as the court reporter. He's given special access to see what's going on here. And when Jesus is telling the disciples about what's going to happen, he specifically has them in mind. Now, D.A. Carson observes here, the oblique manner of reference, another disciple, calls to mind the beloved disciple, who is so regularly unnamed. This is more striking when we compare, when we remember the close connection between the beloved disciple and Peter. So that's something we've observed here, is the beloved disciple and Peter are constantly being compared. He's the beloved disciple is the one sitting next to Jesus. And then Peter has to motion to the beloved disciple and say, what did he say? The beloved disciple has better access. And when you see the entire structure of the synoptics, that it's they're all weighted on Peter's testimony. He's the foundation, the one upon whom Christ builds his church. He's the one who starts by preaching in the day of Pentecost, and 3,000 are converted. His stories are the ones that are remembered by Mark and by Matthew and others. He sort of sets the tone. And so the beloved disciple is, Richard Bauckham's language is, he's the ideal witness. His witness goes a little bit further. He was there at the beginning. This other anonymous disciple is there at the beginning before Peter. He spent the afternoon before Peter ever arrived. There's always this comparison going on, and he has the ideal witness that extends further than that of the main witness of the Gospels. So Carson says, whoever this man was, he was not only able to walk into the high priest's courtyard without being questioned, he was also able to speak to the servant girl attending the gate to ensure Peter was admitted as well. This is the bizarre thing. For the thesis that this is the beloved disciple, and that the beloved disciple is John the Apostle, this is hard. How does John the Apostle, this Galilean fisherman, have A, the courage to walk in with all the guards, instead of scattering? He walks in with Jesus, and he's not hanging around Peter in the courtyard. He's actually in the other area with Jesus. How does he have that? How is he admitted into the courtyard? How is he admitted here during this late night trial proceeding? It's just weird. People say, well, a fisherman, he sold the high priest fish. Okay, so he sold the fish, but it's a trial in the middle of the night. There's no fish selling going on here. But beyond that, he has the authority to speak to the girl to allow this other disciple in. That requires some explanation. Very, very interesting. And that's what Carson's pointing out here. Now, C.H. Dodd, again, this liberal guy in the 60s, writes, it is now generally recognized that nostos, this word for he was known to the high priest. This other disciple was known. This word nostos implies something more than mere acquaintance. It means that the person so described was a member of the high priest's circle, possibly a kinsman, and himself of priestly birth, or at any rate, one who stood in intimate relations with the governing high priestly family. Wow. That is really interesting and provocative. And that is something that, if you look at the way that word is used in the Synoptic Gospels, it's like Jesus, as a young 12-year-old boy, travels with his family and his close family members. So it's the relatives and the nostos. It's these super. It's like really tight knit clan. If it's not relative here, then it's somebody who's somehow really connected to the high priestly clan. But it can mean relative. But maybe it's also being anonymized a bit by using this softer language of nostos rather than the word for relative, because that would identify him too much. But he's really well known to the circle of high priests. And he has the authority, and he has no fear. He has no fear of being there. But that is something that a lot of commentators do wrestle with. And sometimes you'll see them wrestling with it on one side. They say this because he's so well known. And you look at this language, you look at the verbs, you look at the noun, adjective. You look at these words and you say, this does not look like the Apostle John. And therefore, it's not John the Apostle. It's just some other Jerusalem disciple. But then you look at the connection between how he's being related to Peter, and you look at the structure of John's gospel. You say, no, it's the beloved disciple. It's the guy who wrote this gospel. But maybe it's still not the Apostle John. Next page, top of page 4. So this Cambridge scholar from the early 1900s named Henry Barclay Sweet wrote, "It is scarcely conceivable that a Galilean disciple drawn from the fishermen of the northern lake would have stood in this relation to the head of the exclusive aristocracy which virtually ruled the Jewish people. This disciple, whoever he was, must have been a person of influence and possibly of the family of high priests." So this is based on the recent books on commentaries on the Gospel of John, and he's the one that has with the Gospel's beloved disciple, primarily on the grounds that if the narrator had wished to make the figure who is unidentified when he bears witness in 1935, is almost certainly meant to be understood as the disciple whom Jesus loved. I would cross out the word almost there, because he is identified at verse 26 and 27 as the beloved disciple. And then later, that same man gives, you know, witness to what he sees when Jesus is, you know, bleeding blood and water. So, yes, he's identified there in 1927, 26 through 35. In the Passion narrative, the beloved disciple is portrayed as the only male disciple not to abandon Jesus. And so there is there at the foot of the cross in 25 through 27. Here, the other disciple has not left Jesus, but is depicted in line with the beloved disciple's characterization as Jesus' closest and most intimate follower, as actually entering the high priest's courtyard with Jesus. He also serves as a witness who guarantees the Johannine interpretation of these events. In other words, how is it that we know what Caiaphas and others said to Jesus during that trial? Because the author of the gospel was present as a witness there and heard what he says, and that's how we know that that information is reliable. Here, the mention of his presence with Jesus and his access to the high priest's setting enables him to serve as a narrative source for the knowledge of what takes place at the interrogation. Finally, Alan Culpepper observes, he wrote this in 1994, "While it is not impossible that the son of Zebedee was known by the high priest, this passage here in John 18 must be considered among the difficulties for the traditional interpretation that the beloved disciple is the Apostle John. The beloved disciple regularly appears where he is given some priority or advantage over Peter. And if we identify the other disciple as the beloved disciple, then this scene implies his faithfulness in contrast to Peter's failure." Wow, that becomes huge in terms of that overall contrast. This is like the climax of that contrast, where here Peter is at the place of his denying Jesus three times. And yet this beloved disciple, who's always being contrasted throughout the gospel, is there with courage and no fear and being with Jesus, and then is with him at the cross. It's like the climax of that comparison, why the beloved disciple is the ideal witness who writes the gospel. Now, as we close, here are some reflections throughout church history about the identity of this beloved disciple, this other disciple. Is it John? Is it the beloved disciple? Here's what people have said about John's identity in some way, shape, or form. So Papias, who is, when he says this, it's cited by Eusebius. His works are lost, but there are various people who cite him, so we know that his works existed. And because multiple people cite these same words, we get a good idea that they were historical, and nobody doubts them. So, but if only we could find the actual firsthand copy, because then we could learn a lot. But Papias writes later, maybe sometime in the mid to first quarter of the second century, but he's reflecting on what happened in the past in the first century. And I'll point that out to you as we read these words. "I inquired He was a man of Hierapolis, and so he had the ability to be in a position where he would hear people coming from different directions, people coming from Ephesus in particular. And I would hear what Peter or Andrew or what was said by Philip or Thomas or James. Now, it says what was said, past tense, or John or Matthew or any of the Lord's disciples, and which things Aristion and the other and the presbyter John were saying. Notice here, that's the verb in the present tense, were saying. So he is recollecting a time in the late first century when John the presbyter, this other John, there are two Johns in Ephesus, apparently. There's a number of historical records. But here's a reflection from the late first century that there were two Johns. John the Apostle, the disciple who's mentioned with the others, and then this John the Elder. Remember, we also talked about this in our epistles. We have two highlighted as being written by the Elder John, the presbyter John. Polycrates of Ephesus, he writes this about 190. He says, in Asia, great lights have fallen asleep, to wit, Philip, one of the 12, and John, who was both a witness and a teacher, who reclined at the Lord's side. So he describes Philip as one of the 12 apostles, but he describes John as a witness and teacher and says, this is the guy who reclined at the Lord's side and being a priest wore the sacred plate. So this particular guy, he's from Ephesus, and he records there's a tradition in Ephesus that said John, there's a difference between, he doesn't mention him as an apostle. He mentions him as a witness and as a teacher. Witness could be that he's the author of the gospel, and teacher, the author of the epistles. He's a witness and teacher, and he was a high member of the high priestly family, and used to wear the sacred plate. The sacred plate could only be worn by the high priests. This is not a typical priest. This is a member of the high priestly family. Eusebius. There were two persons in Asia that bore the name John, and there were two tombs in Ephesus, each of which, even to the present day, is called John's. Jerome, 347 to 420. Jesus loved the evangelist John more than the other disciples. So loved evangelist. So this is the beloved disciple. Jerome is saying the beloved disciple is the author of the gospel. For John was of noble birth and known to the high priest. There's a tradition in Jerome's day that the beloved disciple who wrote the gospel was of the high priestly family and of nobility. Interesting. And yet was so little appalled by the plottings of the Jews that he introduced Peter into his court and was the only one of the apostles bold enough to take his stand before the cross. He does say they're apostles, so he thinks this beloved disciple who was known to the high priest also was the apostle John. Another quote, the other two epistles are said to be the work of John the presbyter, to the memory of whom another sepulchre is shown at Ephesus. So he's thinking two of the epistles John 1 through the epistles of John. He's saying two of them are by the apostle John and two that identify themselves as being written by the elder are by this other John. Anyway, but the point is he knows that there are two Johns in Ephesus. Chrysostom, who is that other disciple that's being referred to here in John 18:15? It is the writer himself. And why does he not name himself? When he reclined at Jesus' side, he with reason concealed his name. But now, why does he do this? He does it for the same reason. In other words, he doesn't tell us the reason, but there is some reason for him to be anonymous. He's anonymous as the beloved disciple. He's anonymous here as the other disciple, but it's the same man, says Chrysostom. He also mentions a deed greatly to his credit that when all had run away, John followed. But observe also how he says that he was known to the high priest, so that none should wonder that he followed or admire him for his courage. In other words, because he was so well known and connected with the high priest of the family, it didn't take courage. That's what he's saying. And I think that's what's true. He's not afraid because he has the authority not only to enter in without fear, but also to speak to the servant girl and to gain access. And that's what Chrysostom says. Now, does he think it's the Apostle John? I don't know. It's not very clear. But he does think this other disciple is the beloved disciple. And finally, Calvin, he says, some have been led astray by a slight conjecture to suppose that this disciple was the evangelist John because he is accustomed to speak of himself without mentioning his name. But what intimacy with a proud high priest could John have who was a simple fisherman? I agree with Calvin's critique. I just think the best explanation is to say that it's not the simple fisherman, the apostle John, it's the other John. John the Elder. What do you think? Any thoughts? If you are interested, I have a copy from a lecture we did a while ago where it kind of looks through the Gospel of John as a whole, evaluating the parallels, or at least the places in which Peter is sort of presented in some kind of a contrast with this beloved disciple, this anonymous disciple. It seems to be the main thing. Whenever Peter is mentioned, this other anonymous disciple is mentioned, and the anonymous guy ends up getting looking a little bit better. Except for John 6:68. That's the only place Peter's name is mentioned when he doesn't have the other guy mentioned. Norm. The other disciple. In fact, he's that other disciple, whether anonymous or as the Apostle John, unknown to the synoptics. So they had protective anonymity for this guy. They never even mentioned him. He's a guy. He's important. He's a witness to the cross. He gets care of Jesus' mother Mary, but he's not mentioned. He's mentioned here, but without his name. Yes, Heidi. Yes. Right. I did mention that. It is huge. Yeah. Right, yeah. It is a big deal. He has authority. He also has this extra bit of information. He's been there from the beginning. This is something that happened in John 15. You who have been with me from the beginning will report these things. Well, John was the very first one who was there from the beginning, if he's the anonymous witness there in John 1 or 2, in John 1, hanging out with Jesus before even Peter got there. There was another question over here. Yes. You had your hand up? Yes. So that. Yeah, it doesn't say only, so which could be protective anonymity. It does say he's there with the 12, but this other guy isn't mentioned. Just like in the resurrection scenes, an angel appears. It doesn't say only one angel. And the typical apologetic to that is, well, here's another gospel that says there are two angels. Well, it's because the other one didn't say only one angel. Okay? So he is there with the 12, but it doesn't say only the 12. And this particular disciple who is reclining at Jesus' side, he isn't sort of slouched on the side. He reclines at Jesus' side to ask him the question. He's at his right. But he's sitting at the right-hand side because he is the position of authority. If he's the Jerusalem disciple, known to the high priest, part of the high priestly family, he's the guy that owns the apartment and would be at that spot. Jesus is given the guest of honor spot, but he is the person who is the owner of the furnished apartment. What many commentators say, who take the position that this is a Jerusalem disciple, a Jerusalem gospel, connected with the family of high priests. Make sense? Okay. We're out of time. So any final thoughts? We're going to keep discussing this. But basically, the most important doctrine in the Christian faith is not the identity of the beloved disciple or even issues of particular Christian doctrines. The most important doctrine, I think, is what Paul says. If Christ isn't risen, our faith is in vain. That's the thing that all hangs on. Because Paul says, if we will have been found out to be misrepresenting God, and we are, of all men, most to be pitied. If this isn't based on eyewitness information, then we are wasting our time. But if it is based on eyewitness information, and these are real eyewitnesses, which you can kind of get a hint that it is, because they are protecting the sources. You don't need to protect sources that are fictitious. The hare and the tortoise did not need protective anonymity. All right, let's close in prayer. Gracious Father, we ask for your blessings on us this week, this month, this year, as we reflect upon your word, and as we study it as true, that you really did live and walked among us, died on the cross for our sins, and rose on the third day for our justification. We ask that you would continually apply that to us, the reality of that, our new identity in Christ, and help us to walk in that new identity, and help us this morning to worship you reverently in spirit and in truth as we receive your good gifts in the word and in the sacraments. We pray all this in Christ's name. Amen.